dreamt of falling leaves in a wild storm. I was between them as a desolate shore came to meet me, and I ran, scared stiff. There was a trapdoor, but I couldn't lift it. I've started an affair with your son. Took me to a white lakeside hotel, somewhere high up. The lake was endless. I couldn't stop myself. I was in flames from the first spreading of my thighs. No shame could make me push my dress down. I was split open by your thumb at first, and now come back, broken woman, perhaps more broken. Can you do anything for me? Can you understand? In again, you can't conceive how pure the stars are, large as maple leaves up in the mountains. They kept falling, falling into the lake. Don't stop. I don't know if you know how much your son admires the stars. The stars were just up, but when we gazed up through the glass, there were no stars at all. The stars had gone to Earth. I didn't know till then the stars in flakes of snow come down to fuck the Earth. Of mine.
Rose, we're in your exhibition at the Lewis Johnson Gallery, and I think it would be interesting to perhaps start talking about two pieces that are immediately in front of us. That is Rock Drill and Bolt Upright, which certainly Bolt Upright is reminiscent of other pieces I've seen, but on occasions when you've actually carried out performances.
It's interesting that you've recognised it as similar to some other pieces. It is actually a piece that I've made this year for a performance, which was a piece that I wrote for television, so it's a television performance. Mm. It's an image of myself in sort of early teenage, really, I suppose, reading or holding my childhood book of Greek myths and legends, which belonged to my father, which is where I first read the Pandora myth. Mm. And the book is open at that particular page, which shows the image of Pandora by Harry Bates. She isn't actually looking at the book, because balanced on her head is a book. So it's really, in showing it here, what I've done is add the book on the head and she's bolted to a plinth at her feet, even though she's sitting with her feet upright. So the plinth is at right angles to the floor. This was to try and somehow summarise in a static way the mood that I was trying to create in the performance, in my relationship to the figure. And comes from how I felt when I was actually sitting in this position in the performance, which is, in fact, a very, very difficult position to sustain, though it looks fairly easy, which I think is a sort of analogy with how women appear and yet the difficulty of sustaining that appearance.
If we could move on to another white cast piece on the right, mm-hmm. called Freeze Frame. Mm-hmm. There are the predominant elements that are seen in a lot of this work. That is the gun, the bird that comes out of Pandora's box, the open book, in relation to four heads that are turning. Are the heads you actually going through these various stages of thinking about the associations of those objects?
Yes, I mean, it links directly back to Bolt Upright. During the performance in which I was sitting next to Bolt Upright, if you like, I was working, looking into a monitor for the television piece. And in order to carry out the director's instructions in certain points, I had to get in quite distorted positions in order to keep the image apparently beautiful within the monitor frame. So for the viewer, one distorted oneself. And I became quite fascinated by the uncomfortableness of the feeling inside and the apparent elegance and beauty of the outer covering. And so that was the idea behind this. It extended into taking the rubber mould of the head for Bolt Upright, which is a self-portrait, traditionally modelled, and distorting that in order to try and create almost the archetypal images that appear in Tumbled Myths, which is Joan of Arc, Pandora, Eve, and the Madonna, Mary. And so it is, in actual fact, exactly the same composition as in that painting, but here produced as a relief.
And there is another element here too, which is the notion of the restricting rectangle, which on both occasions has been sort of expanded and extended, and certainly in Tumbled Myths you've got an additional issue to do with the traditional use of canvas, where the male normally paints on it, and perhaps the female is associated with stitching it and make it into household decoration, because the canvas becomes a curtain, in fact.
It's the notion of how the frame elevates the subject, and how different skills attain different degrees of importance within the hierarchy. It's a work about the promotion of archetypes that are produced from a system that only sees really from one fixed viewpoint. And when women have sufficient influence and insight to create their own archetypal role models, then perhaps the picture will be complete. It's that sort of... I had also the problem that I wanted to utilise the sort of technique and style of the old master painting without actually supporting that system. So it became a question of undermining, subverting the image by some form of destruction, which again I didn't want to destroy it in a violent way, because again that was something that that one is trying to reassess and shift, because that's part of the system that one finds oppressive.
I mean, it might be worth introducing at this point too the fact that the range and approach to media in this work, which I think is extremely strong in relation to the content and subject matter, seems to be to do with the fact that you worked in a very broad sense in the 70s, and this sort of is fed into this work somehow because of its freedoms.
Yes. I think the 70s were a tremendously important exploration time for me, and the delight that I had in the 70s of introducing all those areas of interest and skills as well that had been eradicated from my work, partly by me but partly by the specialisation of college training. That led me into incorporating live work performances into the pieces. And the sort of freedom that I felt in those early performances, I now have felt returning to objects that stand in their own right without a live element. We obviously need to categorise things in order to understand and discuss them. But that's really the core idea behind frameworks, is that those frames in themselves can become so rigid and restricting, the words can become rigid and restricting, and that somehow the whole of this exhibition is about flowing and fluidity and somehow not destruction but transformation of the frame. And in that way the skills have become in a sense almost unimportant, I feel. It's been a delight to be able to utilise any skill that I have within the show. It's been a delight to play with the forms and allow them equal freedom, you know.
Well, you are actually working with associations a great deal, and metaphors, and the what does the gilt frame actually represent?
Yes.
In the next piece, which is Madonna Cascade, again, this one appears to be a fresco.
The whole point of the piece is that it's so awkward to categorise. I mean, you can see what it is, you can recognise it as a painted image within a frame, and yet it is and it isn't, which is my whole ambiguity of the word model, which is written on it, is that the fact is that is it a painted sculpture which is partially wall-based, or is it a fresco, or, you know, where does it begin and end? Where are its perimeters in terms of categorisation to begin with?
Yes.
So model, just in that terms, has all sorts of insights if you follow it into the work. Then the frame is modelled and contains the Madonna, the Virgin Mary, cascading up from the floor into the frame. And you're looking at a woman, traditional artwork, traditional role for woman, being the model, the subject of the painting. But here she's actually holding her palette and brushes, her tools of the trade. So it's actually quite a shocking image the first time you see it, because it's a woman demonstrating her power to place herself in the frame. And to me, they were stunning images when I first saw them, because they have a sense of I am here, you know, a sense of placement. And this is Judith Leister, and is a self-portrait by her of herself as a model. So for me, it becomes an unknown, previously unknown, role model for me and for other women artists.
Okay, and the painting then on the other side of the fireplace, which is called Flaccid Guns, you've recuperated elements from childhood. Why did you feel it necessary to take things from your childhood and to actually rework them and to rejuxtapose them?
Well, it's a flowing process coming this time from the performances out into the static objects, gradually over a period of four years, maybe 5 years. I've, in my performances, explored the relationship of incidents to objects that I still have from my childhood. Perhaps I'm saying that this is something that art has lost, that sort of deep attachment into the collective mind. And so perhaps I'm starting with my own personal attachment as a beginning point, at least. And what I've tried to do is select objects that I do believe have got some sort of universal symbolism. So the gun, the Madonna, immediately read in a particular way to people without explanation. I think that it is beautiful always to have more knowledge of the artist who made the work, Van Gogh cutting off his ear gives you an insight into, and it's a hook for a lot of people into the work. It's not essential, but again, in the performances, the disclosure of private and internal information is made in such a way that the incidents are put into a perspective where I think everyone makes a parallel remembrance, you know. There is a similar memory, a similar moment. So for me, to come back to the gun was my father's service revolver specifically, but it was something which was always locked away, which I was not allowed access to, quite sensibly. Now, it may not be that anyone else has got exactly that memory, but every child knows the box they were not allowed to open, whether it's the medicine cabinet or whatever. But there's this sense of being excluded from a territory, is what I'm getting at. Whether one actually wants to take on what's in the territory when one's allowed in is the next stage of the freedom. The first stage of the freedom is actually gaining access to the territory.
Yes, and of course the other layer of that is of wider understanding in terms of that as a symbol is the notion of the gun as a symbol of male potency.
I've done exactly the same with the guns as with Madonna's. I've made them melt. Here, obviously, it has comments on potency. But I don't think it's to do with impotency, as it's again to do with the hierarchy that puts the notion of impotency as something that's completely outside the role
of the male.
There's a sense of optimism, I think, in all the pieces, but there is always present a sense of dilemma, I think, too, which is very much how I feel as a woman, how I feel that most women, when they come to any sort of decision-making, there's such a more complex picture that they're seeing than most men have to deal with. When we start to talk about ideologies, then I begin to get worried, because for me the freedom for women at the moment is of exploration. I don't want to draw up sets of rules that are as rigid as the sets of rules that have been drawn up already that give us so many problems. So the notion of exploring to me is where the optimism comes in, and so these works are informed by feminism, but to do with reaching out into something that I don't know about, which is what every artist does, reaching out into an area that you haven't predetermined the answers to.
The next item on this tape is by Susan Hiller. It's an extract from the soundtrack from Ilan, and ideally should be heard over loudspeakers.
Amika Dayang Asakai Sakai Manahalahawanan Wasajiman Akahai Sahaisa Haisa Haisan Wasaki Sahai Dahuaniman Ida vava si daha hasialan hasakimon hasakaidaha.
The text spoken by the voices and the sound volume are exactly the same as in the original recording. To help the ear adapt itself to the strange rhythm, rapidity and softness of the voice entity's speech, each utterance is repeated several times.
Now the experimenter calls the Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, and the voice answers. Mayakovsky. The experimenter tells the poet how difficult it is to convince people of the reality of the voice phenomenon, and in reply comes a statement which is typical for Mayakovsky's personality. Konstantin, pluj. In Russian, Konstantin, spit on it. The experimenter talks to his former teacher, the Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset, and the voice calls out, Ortega. The experimenter asks whether the research into the voice phenomenon had any significance and whether it was based on firm foundations. The voice answers, Entrojas muchas cuestiones. Spanish, you will solve many questions.
Ivasakidaham alahadihiman Ivasahadalam asakadim asakadimal Nanamikaisahan akahimasan akadim Nisakai san akaim idayana anai an asi akayalam hu
The voice of an entity whom the experimenter does not know, but who calls herself Agnes, a helper, probably remarks here on unfavorable recording conditions. Agnes, furchtbar slicht. German and Latvian. Agnes, terribly bad. A voice, later identified as that of a man who lived and died in a place called Kirnbach in the Black Forest, Germany, says, Wartet auf Walter von Kirnbach. German, wait for Walter from Kirnbach. A voice called James Joyce. Now a voice, which may be Winston Churchill's, says, Mark you, make believe, my dear, yes. Followed by Winston Churchill.
Dayan Asakai Sakai Manahalahawanan Wasajiman Akahai Sahaisa Haisa Haisan Wasaki Sahai Dahuaniman Ida Vava Sida Hasialan Hasakimon Hasakai Dahamon My Kasa Makil Havinam Hasaka Hadisal Havikahalan Asi Kaharam Abi Abi Nal Asahadi Mahadi Sahanam Asahi Dahamin Abasai Dal Avahai Sam Amahai Lah.
The following sentence, heard at the end of a recording session, indicates that the voice entities have their own transmitting stations. Wat nun, gute Nacht von Citadi. Russian and German. Now good night from Citadi.
Asanam Amikadayan Asakai Sakai Manahalahawanan Wasajiman Akahai Sahaisa Haisa Haisan Wasaki Sahai Dahuaniman Ida vava sida hasialan hasakimon hasakaidaha.
Language as system, language as symptom, language as shock, the fragmented body. They build walls out of fragments. She builds a wall against silence. 5 seconds of silence for the dead, starting now. their silent memorial. The enigma of divided origins, tradition and inspiration, fruitful incoherence, formless production, aimless production as expression. Here, language breaks free. Outside of its own quotation, the voice is a relic.
We've just, in fact, come out of your performance here at Riverside, Glenn, of Symphony No. 4. I mean, were you satisfied with the actual performance tonight?
Well, yeah, I've generally been satisfied with the performance. We've just been having some sound problems, which finally got rectified by the last performance, basically.
In fact, I was here in 1979 for your performance with The Static. Where has the transition taken place where you've arrived at the point where you actually changed to the extent you've changed with the lineup and with the sound?
Well, actually, now that you mentioned that concert at the Riverside a few years ago, the transition took place immediately after that concert. I got back to New York and there was an opportunity to do a concert that wasn't... where I wasn't intended to show a band, just to do a piece on my own. So I decided to put together a piece with six guitars. That was about 3 weeks after the concert at the Riverside with The Static. And that was the first thing I did with a lot of guitars.
What about this particular work, Symphony No. 4? Can we talk about the three parts in turn? Because, you know, I recorded little snatches from each. I mean, what about section one, which started off fairly quietly and then built up?
Well, the first section is mainly interesting because most of the chords are derived from charts that I've made, which are based on the intervals of the harmonic series. And what's interesting is that the chords are not actually designed by me. I mean, I didn't write those chords. I put them into a structure, and they're somewhat orchestrated, but the actual... notes that make up the chords and where they go in, basically in which octave they go, and is determined completely from the harmonic series. So it is something that I want to get to the public. I want them to understand, because there's no doubt that if people understood where some of this was coming from, it would be much more interesting. It's interesting to me, for instance, that there are... I mean, chords that we relate to Mahler or Wagner or any number of other composers, Beethoven, and sometimes these people are mentioned in reviews about me. In the case of this piece and the last piece, most of those chords were not written by me or anyone else. They're basically, derived from calculations based on the interval relationships that occur when a string is vibrating. And there's an infinite number of harmonics that are sounded in order to create the tone that you hear and consider to be one tone. It's not really one tone. It's an incredible variety of tones, some of them more prominent than others, and that's what gives a sound its nature or its timbre. Basically taken the series in its purest form and used it as a tuning system. And that's the tuning system I'm using here. I'm using the first seven octaves of this series, which is an infinite series. It's interesting about this tuning that in relationship to the equal temperament of the tuning that is used in the Western world, that of course in equal temperament every octave has 12 notes in it. In the harmonic series, each octave has a different number of tones, and it develops in a logarithmic pattern.
Do you want to actually say anything about the second movement? I mean, is it crucially different?
Well, the second movement has a different intention in mind here. Really, the first movement presents these chords in a listenable manner, you could say. And it ends, you can see, actually the first movement is divided into three parts, and each one of those could be discussed separately. But as far as the second movement goes, I'm making a very definite effort to activate the potential of the acoustic phenomena in the space. And I call it continuous field because I'm setting up a continuous field of sound. It's basically just a descriptive title for the movement. And in this field, I'm trying to create harmonic movement which will generate acoustic phenomena. So there's some phenomena that I'm familiar with and are quite well known to anyone who studied acoustics. Resultant tones, the combinational tones. And combinational tones are interesting because they're really just combinations of certain harmonics, and you can just add the harmonics together and you can figure out what the combinational tone or the third tone, the ghost tone sometimes it's called, which is going to be sounded. Just to get off the subject a second, I mean, one of the things I was interested in with this tuning was to actually try to determine consciously some of the resultants, but I have to say that really hasn't been very possible, or at least what I thought I wanted wasn't really resultants, but I won't go on about that. But as far as the second movement's concerned, that's basically what I was trying to do. I found to get the kind of harmonic movement and the resonance in a room that I want, it requires that the room sort of get warmed up, that I've got to have a lot of harmonic activity that is continuously developing in the room. It could have to do with how the ear works, what goes on in someone's ear. Maybe that's what needs to be warmed up, I don't know. But I can say that this continuous field is what is necessary in order to get some of this activity going. So that's the second move.
unison clusters being the third movement.
Well, in that movement, there are two things I was working for. One goes back to something I've been working with since I can remember with music, and it's really just an idea of what I usually think call an emotional structure, and I'm just trying to find any means whatsoever to somehow get to what it is that I intuitively feel without really being able to put it into words or to describe it. I find many times it's easy to get onto to get off the track and to get involved in technical things, and I like to fool around with that a bit, but I do always want to try to come back to the heart of the matter, to get back to what it is I'm really thinking about every day, you know, but never talk about. And I don't know what I can't really say, but I try to somehow put that into music. And when I do that, I don't think about anything involving the technical aspect at all. And like, for instance, in this piece, I use this idea of unison clusters, which is interesting to me because usually a unison is thought of as a number of tones which are all the same. But when you start looking into the nature of the physical nature of sound, you see there are no two tones that could ever be exactly the same. And really, and the number of unisons, so so-called unisons being sounded together, are actually creating a very dense, narrow cluster. It really is true. And the higher the volume is, the more that this cluster can be perceived. And I like the idea of using the most basic possible musical language, which is a unison sound, and also a sound that I've used in a lot of my pieces and what I've worked with, but never in this particular way, as the language that I wanted to try to get this idea out, the most basic possible musical word, you know, like this. So that's the third movement.
Performing like a classical conductor. You're in front of your ensemble, conducting it. I mean, is that something that is now absolutely essential to control the range of instruments and musicians that you work with?
Well, it's actually a lot more essential than I thought it was going to be or intended it to be when I started to do it. Like everything else in my music, it started to happen because it was necessary for me to give cues and I wasn't able to play an instrument. There was one piece that finally happened where I couldn't continue to play the instrument and give the cues. It was just as simple as that, and I started giving the cues. What developed out of that was then I discovered in another piece that came later that there was a necessity not only to give cues, but when I wasn't hearing what I wanted to hear, to begin to gesture and to begin to demand to hear what I wanted to hear, what I knew was there, what you might say, what I had heard in rehearsal, or what I knew I could get out of the piece. And really, I, a couple of years ago, was making an effort to try to write music that wasn't going to be necessary to have me present with. But now it's become clear that it's absolutely necessary that I have to... I have to work with the music because I know what it can sound like and where it can go, and it's got to be pushed in that direction because it's ambiguous music. Anyone else who would be up there would push it in a different direction because they'd be hearing a different aspect. Plus the fact I've worked with it for so long now, I know where it can go and what has to be done to get it there. Now sometimes it doesn't work, but. So basically, that's what the conducting thing is about. As far as the references to classical conductors, I've never seen very much classical music performed live. Occasionally, I suppose I've seen Leonard Bernstein on television. So I suppose, you know, that's who I'm emulating. But I'm only kidding. And I mean, I had nothing to do with any of that. And now that it's constantly being talked about. it goes through my head sometimes, and sometimes I make fun of it. I do what I feel like. I find myself making a certain gesture. Sometimes I'll overplay the gesture. I'll push it. I'll turn it into something totally different than what it is. But I would prefer not to have those thoughts go through my mind at all. It really has nothing to do with the music.
So apart from four electric guitars and the drums, the rest of the keyboard instruments are constructed. Is that the case? I mean, you've actually had them made, which is a fairly sophisticated kind of problem. I mean, why have the keyboard instruments constructed from scratch?
Well, that goes back to strictly technical considerations. There are two major reasons why I needed the keyboards. Before the keyboards, there were mallet guitars that I had built, I should mention, and those were also built for similar reasons. But the keyboards specifically were built because, as I said, in the harmonic series, there are as many as 64 notes in one octave. Even 32 is quite a lot. In a conventional stringed instrument, it's not really possible to tune that many different tones in the course of one octave because of the way the instrument's built. It's physically not possible to do it. Plus the fact I want to work with thin strings and I want to work with a resonant string sound, which means as opposed to a guitar, when you're holding your finger on the string, it's dampening 75% of the harmonic texture of the tone. And I really wanted that open string guitar sound. Any guitarist knows what that sounds like as opposed to when you're holding your fingers on the chord. So it was necessary to get involved with keyboards because I'd have to be dealing with 20 and 30 and 40 guitars, which I don't want to. I'm not interested in having millions of guitars on the stage. I just want to get the sound. So I've got a keyboard that has as many strings as 10 or 15 guitars, basically, and I can play them all open, and I can get all the notes I want in the range that I want. It's basically as simple as that, and that's why the keyboards were built.